It's time for dessert. We have two presentations this evening. Our first speaker is Nancy Piercy, and she's the author of the newly released Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality. She is professor and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University, editor at large of the Piercy Report. Her earlier books include The Soul of Science, Saving Leonardo, Finding Truth, Total Truth, and How Shall We Now Live? Hailed in The Economist as America's preeminent evangelical Protestant female intellectual, Piercy has spoken at universities such as Princeton, Stanford, USC, and Dartmouth. I think The Economist certainly has that right. If you read her books, you'll know that. Very clear, concise, thorough. Just really wonderful books. I highly recommend them. So, would you please join in welcoming Nancy Piercy.
Thank you for that introduction. When I was agreed to talk about this subject several months ago, I had no idea how relevant it would be. The Kavanaugh hearings have certainly made these issues cutting edge right now. I had an article published in the Daily Caller 2 days ago in which I said the Kavanaugh hearings have became a referendum on whether masculinity is presumptively toxic. And I also had a chance to talk, this also was planned several months in advance. I spoke to a group of staffers on Capitol Hill, right in the heart, in the heat of the hearings. And I asked especially the women staffers, many of them worked for members of Congress who were key figures in the hearing. And so I wanted to get their take on it. And listen to this. This was also in my Daily Caller piece. They said, the Me Too movement was founded on justified anger against men using their power against women for sexual purposes. But now that movement is being betrayed and weaponized for political advantage. So that was a firsthand perspective of women who are working right now on Capitol Hill with some of these key senators. Let me start out with a few examples that will also help you see how relevant these issues are. It was the Claremont Colleges that had an article on the Facebook warning masculinity can be extremely toxic to our mental health. A Salon article said, the three most destructive words a father or mother can tell their young son, be a man. The Washington Post, I'm sure some of you saw this one. Washington Post carried an article by a gender studies professor titled, Why Can't We Hate Men? The professor said, we have every right to hate you. You have done us wrong. / because patriarchy. How's that relevance for our patriarchy conference? The fact that it was published in a mainstream national newspaper is one measure of how the hostility toward men is considered acceptable to express. And let's give an example on the Me Too side. This was from an article I published in Fox News, and it was when it was first revealed that Silicon Valley is now known to be as sexually debauched as Hollywood, the political world, and the media. Many titans of the tech world, entrepreneurs, executives, investors, founders of companies, regularly host drug-fueled, sex-laced parties. Women working in the tech industry feel pressured to attend and participate in these parties or lose their jobs. But if they do attend, then they lose their professional status because they're reduced to sex object instead of competent professionals. So either way, they lose. So that's the topic I'd like to address tonight. Why is there so much tension between the sexes today? And the answer is twofold. First, the moral standards that Western culture holds up for men have gone down. Society does not expect men to have the high moral character that we expected of them in the past. And at the same time, the standards that women have for men have gone up in the sense that they feel justified in making greater moral demands on men. So the standards for men have gone down while the demands that women make on men have gone up. And I'm going to start by digging into some of this history. I want to show you how this developed over time, and then I'll end with talking about how Christianity offers a real solution. So let's start with a little history. I think you'll be surprised at what we find. On the other hand, given Chris Riley's talk today earlier, you won't be surprised. I'll be filling out details on what he said earlier. For most of human history, most people lived on family farms or in peasant villages. And that was true here in America right through colonial times. So what that meant was that productive work was done in the home or its outbuildings, in the household. Work was not the father's job. It was the family industry. As one historian writes, for colonial women, marriage meant to become a co-worker beside a husband, learning new skills in butchering, silversmith work, printing, or upholstering, whatever special skills the husband's work required. Now, if you've lived overseas, you probably have seen this pattern. When I was in seventh grade, we lived in a village outside of Heidelberg, Germany. And to go shopping, we would take a bag and walk down the street to the baker, then to the butcher, then to the grocer, and so on, because each storefront was located in the front of a home. The family lived upstairs or in the back rooms, and so husband and wife worked together all day, sharing in the same economic enterprise. In fact, school would let out at noon. 1 o'clock was the latest, all the way through high school. Why? So the kids could go home and help with the family business. So I would often see my classmates stocking shelves or running the cash register. So as late as 1960s in a German village, you could still experience the colonial or the pre-industrial work style, where a business was a genuine family enterprise. Now, the fact that all this took place in the home meant that both parents could combine economically productive work with raising children. Being a father was not a separate activity that you came home to after a day at work. There were a few exceptions, like sailors and soldiers, but most fathers were a visible presence in the home, day in and day out. They introduced their children to the world of work. They trained them to work alongside them. How do we know all this? The literature on parenting, like sermons and child-rearing manuals, was addressed typically to fathers, not to mothers, as most of them are today. Fathers were held to be especially important in their children's religious and intellectual training. Do you see the remarkably similar images from the Reformation all the way through the 19th century? Today we talk about housewives, but in the colonial era, heads of household were sometimes called house fathers. One historian says, not only artisans and farmers, but also business and professional men conducted much of their work in the house, assisted by their wives and children. They all ate and prayed together. They got up and went to bed on the same schedule. Surprising as it may sound, the same historian goes on, men were as comfortable in the kitchen as women, for they had responsibility for provisioning and managing the house. Cookbooks and domestic conduct books were directed primarily to men, as they were as devoted to decor as they were to hospitality. In other words, in their day-to-day life, colonial fathers may have been closer to the Reformation than they are to today. Martin Luther once said, when a father washes diapers and performs some other mean task for his child, and someone ridicules him as an effeminate fool, he should remember that God, with all his angels and creatures, is smiling. Now, all of this did not diminish a father's authority in the home. The colonists were influenced by classical republicanism, a political theory modeled on the Roman Republic. And in this theory, the person in authority was the one who had responsibility for the common good. So a social institution, whether a marriage, a family, church, or state, was regarded as an organic unity. And so in classical thought, there was what was good for the individual, but there was also what was good for the social institution itself as an organic unity, the marriage, the family, the civil society. And what was good for the social institution was the common good. So everyone naturally pursues their own good, right? I look out for what's best for me, you look out for what's best for you. But who looks out for the common good? That's what authority was for. A position of authority was an office, and the person in that office had a duty to sacrifice his own individual interests and ambitions to pursue the interests of the whole, the common good, whether that was a marriage, family, church, or civil society. So, for example, in America, a man was expected to fulfill himself not so much through personal success, but through public usefulness. Isn't that a nice phrase? Serving the public good. And that's what was meant by civic virtue, self-denial for the common good. So how did we lose all this? The change began with the Industrial Revolution, which took work out of the home into new factories and textile mills. That may seem like a simple change, the physical location of work, but it had enormous social consequences. First of all, men had little choice but to follow their work out of the home, out of households and fields, and into factories and offices. Husband and wife no longer worked side by side. One historian says, the decline of family and domestic industry shattered the interdependent relationship between husband and wife. Second, it became difficult for fathers to continue anything like their traditional parental role. They simply no longer spent enough time with their children to educate them, enforce regular discipline, train them in adult skills and trades. So how do we know this? The most striking feature in the mid-19th century is the disappearance of references to fathers. For the first time, we find sermons and pamphlets and books on childbearing addressed exclusively to mothers. The world of industrial capitalism also fostered a new definition of masculinity. For the first time, men were no longer working side by side with their wives and children. Instead, they were working all day with other men who were not related to them, which meant they now worked as an individual in competition with other individuals. In the new industrial workplace, workers were treated as so many interchangeable units plugged into the production process, each one struggling to advance himself at the expense of others. In this new context, it seemed necessary for men to act under the impulse of self-interest and personal ambition. One historian says, the ideal of manhood changed dramatically at the turn of the 19th century. The key word now was self, self-improvement, self-cultivation, the self-made man. In political theory, there was a shift from the household as the basic unit of society to the individual. Modern liberalism took its model from physics. The apex of the scientific revolution was Newtonian physics, which pictured the material world as so many atoms, hard little balls of matter, bumping around in the void, driven by natural forces. The same metaphor was applied to the social world. After all, everyone wanted to be scientific. So social philosophers constructed what they called a social physics, where civil society was pictured as a collection of human atoms, independent, disconnected individuals who come together only out of self-interest. The implication is that communities are not organic, united by a common good. They are only aggregates of individuals. And if there is no common good, then authority can no longer be defined in terms of responsibility for protecting the common good. Men no longer were called to self-sacrifice for the good of the whole. They were set free to pursue self-interest. People began saying that morality had no place in the realm of politics, business, and industry, that the public sphere should be value-free. Well, what did that mean for values? You were supposed to leave them behind in the private sphere. You're not supposed to bring your private values into the public realm, into your work, your professional life, your politics. And since men were the ones who worked in that public square, there was less expectation that they would act on duty or moral principles. And eventually, the male character was redefined as tough, pragmatic, and morally hardened. Are you starting to see the themes? Western culture began expecting less of men, lowering the bar on what it means to be a man. Of course, people still desperately wanted to maintain values, kindness, affection, altruism, self-sacrifice, piety. And if there's no place for them in the public realm, where would they be cultivated? In the private sphere. And there they became the task of women. Women were called upon to cultivate the values that had been stripped from the value-free public arena. They were to maintain the home as a private haven where men could be renewed, reformed, and refined. This was called the doctrine of separate spheres. A sharp dichotomy was drawn between private and public realms. And in the 19th century, it was the main coping mechanism to protect the values that were being endangered as society secularized. So one 19th century advice book said, "The world corrupts, home should refine." A prominent scholar sums up by saying, in the 19th century, the family became a special protected place, the repository of tender, pure, and generous feelings embodied in the mother, and a bulwark and bastion against the raw, competitive, aggressive, and selfish world of commerce embodied by the father. This was a dramatic reversal. In the colonial days, husbands and fathers had been admonished to be the moral and spiritual leaders of the household. But now men were being told that they were naturally crude and brutish, and that they needed to learn virtue from their wives. And many men accepted that message. Give me two examples. During the Civil War, the Confederate general William Pender wrote to his wife, "Whenever I find my mind wandering upon bad and sinful thoughts, I try to think of my good and pure wife, and they leave me at once. You are truly my good angel. I have almost come to feel that you are part of my religion." And to be even-handed, on the Union side, Ulysses S. Grant wrote to his sweetheart Julia that, "If I feel tempted to do anything I now think is not right, I ask myself, if Julia saw me, would I do so? And thus it is, absent or present, I am more or less governed by what I think is your will." So this is the origin of the double standard, the idea that women naturally have a greater moral sensitivity. And on the one hand, this seems to empower women, right? There had never been a time before in all history when women were considered morally superior to men. From the time of the ancient Greeks, people thought knowing right and wrong was a rational insight, and that men were more rational, and therefore men were more virtuous. They were morally stronger than women. Now, for the first time in history, women were said to be morally superior, especially in regard to things like sex and alcohol. Women were thought to be naturally more pure, and therefore it was their right to hold men accountable. But But there was an underlying dynamic in all this that was very troubling. As one historian says, in essence, America was releasing men from the responsibility to be virtuous. Look at this quote. Women took men's place as the custodians of communal virtue, but in doing so, they were freeing men to pursue self-interest. In other words, they were letting men off the hook. So in this illustration, I don't know if you, I hope you can see it from where you're sitting. The woman is begging her husband not to go out drinking with his buddy, to stay home and eat dinner with his family. But you notice his body is already turned toward the door. He's heading out. In other words, the concept of masculinity was being demoralized. To be masculine was no longer equated with being virtuous. Instead, virtue was something that women enforced upon men. So where was the Christian church in the 19th century? Did the church stand against this demoralization of the masculine character? Unfortunately, the answer is largely no. After centuries of teaching that husbands and fathers are divinely called to the office of headship in the home, the church began to pitch its appeal primarily to women. Churchmen began to speak of women as having a special gift for religion and morality. Much of American evangelicalism was born in the two great awakenings, and especially in the second awakening, tended to redefine religion in terms of an intense emotional conversion experience. And since women were thought to be more emotional than men, that seemed to put religion squarely in the province of women. In many evangelical churches, women began to outnumber men, often 2-1. If you look carefully at engravings made of camp meetings, you often see women dominating the image, swooning and fainting. Do you see that? When the British novelist Frances Trollope visited America in 1832, she said, "She'd never seen a country where religion had so strong a hold upon the women, or a slighter hold upon the men." Even the tone of religion became feminized. There's a classic book on the subject called The Feminization of American Culture. And it says, "The ministry lost a toughness, a sternness, an intellectual rigor, which our society has been accustomed to identify with masculinity, and instead took on the feminine traits of care, nurturing, sentimentalism, and retreat from the harsh competitive ethos of the public arena." And as you can see, even the artwork became soft and sentimentalized. This is when the stereotype arose that religion is for women and children. It was being turned into something soft and comforting, not bracing and challenging. In the literature of the time, ministers began urging women to be the means of converting their worldly husbands. And this was especially true among liberal Protestants. So this is a Unitarian minister. He says, "We look to you, ladies, to raise the standard of character of our own sex, that is, of men. We look to you to guard and fortify those barriers which still exist in society against the encroachments of impudence and licentiousness. We look to you for the continuance of domestic purity, for the revival of domestic religion, for the increase of our charities, and for the support of what remains of religion in our private habits and public institutions." Now, the idea that men are naturally less spiritual and less virtuous, that they are naturally more inclined to sin and vice, was hugely insulting to men. It was patronizing and degrading. Not surprisingly, it created enormous resentment on the part of men. One historian says, "The ideology of separate spheres was nothing less than a plan for female government of male passions. But it had a paradoxical effect. It gave men the freedom to be aggressive, greedy, ambitious, competitive, and self-interested, and then left women with the duty of curbing this behavior." So look at this image from the temperance movement. The women are actually kneeling and praying in the street. Remember, religion is for women. While the men eye them resentfully from the door and windows of the saloon. The tension is palpable. Women began to argue that the private realm is affected by public vices like drunkenness and prostitution, and therefore women have the right to go out into the public realm to address these issues. Here's how one woman put it at the time. The affairs of government and industry have been too long dominated by the crude, warlike, acquisitive, hard-headed, amoral qualities of men. They should no longer be deprived of the tempering influence of women's compassion, spirituality, and moral sensitivity. The doctrine of, in the 19th century, there were so many reform movements that historians refer to them collectively as the benevolent empire. And it was the doctrine of separate spheres that fueled many of these reform movements because it seemed to grant legitimacy to women's efforts to control men's behavior. Here's another historian. Oh, sorry. It granted legitimacy to women's efforts. Oh, see the images? So this is in particular the temperance movement was a major movement at the time. And these are quite colorful images. Women are not holding back, are they? Okay, and here's what one historian says. Almost all the female reform associations were implicit condemnations of males. There was little doubt as to the sex of slave masters, tavern keepers, drunkards, and seducers. And when those drunkards came home at night, this is how they treated their family. So the message was that men are inherently coarse and immoral, and that virtue is a womanly trait imposed upon men only through great travail. In the past, the concept of virtue had been primarily a masculine trait. It was defined in terms of things like courage and civic duty. Now the concept of virtue was transformed into a feminine trait. However, the attempt to make women the moral reformers of men was self-defeating. Why? When virtue is defined as a feminine quality instead of a human quality, requiring men to be virtuous was seen as the imposition of a feminine standard. Being virtuous took on tones of being effeminate. And when that happened, inevitably, men began to resist. By the late 19th, early 20th century, a reaction set in. Men began to rebel against female efforts to reform them. A new word entered the American language, over-civilized. Men began to worry that boys were now growing up too exclusively under the tutelage of mothers and female teachers. They were becoming soft and effeminate. And by the way, this raises an issue I haven't talked about yet. What did the Industrial Revolution mean for children? For the first time, boys were growing up without day-to-day contact with their fathers. Today we have masses of sociological studies showing the negative effects of growing up with no father at all. But how many of those negative effects began to show up when for the first time fathers were gone all day, when they were disengaged, when boys were essentially unsupervised for much of the time? Girls were affected too, of course, but they did have daily contact with their mothers, who provided a model of what it meant to be a woman. By contrast, boys no longer had a concrete model, day in, day out, of what it means to be a man. Mothers tried to step in and fill the gap left by missing fathers, but boys often resented the imposition of what they saw as female standards. Some historians even say that mandatory schooling was started primarily as a way of giving these boys some structure in their day. But most school teachers were women as well. So what this meant is that boys spent much of their growing up years resisting structure, order, and discipline as something that was imposed by women. They developed what historians called boy culture, the idea that being a real boy meant being wild, free, adventuresome, breaking all the rules. This is when so-called bad boy books became a popular genre, the best known being Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn. At the end of the book, Huck takes off for lands unknown because Aunt Sally, she's going to adopt me and civilize me, and I can't stand it. Notice that civilizing is something done by old maid aunts. Organizations also began to address the problem of boys needing father figures, father substitutes. The 1914 American Boy Scouts manual said, "The wilderness is gone, the buckskin man is gone, the painted Indian has hit the trail over the Great Divide. The privations and hardships of pioneer life, which did so much to produce sterling manhood, are now but a legend. And we must depend on the Boy Scout movement to produce the men of the future." As these boys grew up, they began to produce literary works for adults that also sounded a note of male rebellion. There arose new genres of cowboy and adventure fiction written by such authors as Jack London and Owen Wister. Books that celebrated the man who had escaped the confines of domesticity. Do you know who Owen Wister is? He was the author of the first Western. He invented the genre. A new emphasis was laid on the wild, untamed masculine nature. This is when Legends of the Lost Frontier became popular, like the lives of Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone. Some writers even began to celebrate the male as primitive, aggressive, crude, barbarian. They praised his animal instincts and animal energy. The Tarzan books, featuring a wild man raised by apes, became immensely popular. There was a whole series. You probably know it just from television, but there was a whole series that were incredibly popular. This new definition of masculinity also reflected the influence of Darwin's theory of evolution. For if humans evolved from the animal world, the implication was that the animal nature was the core of our being. So from antiquity, virtue had been defined as the exercise of restraint of the lower passions by the higher faculties of reason, spirit, and moral will. But now, in a stunning reversal, the animal passions and instincts were held up as the true self, at least for men. The masculine nature was being redefined as tough, combative, governed by the biological instinct for lust and power. In the 1950s, Playboy made its appearance, warning that women are economic parasites, gold diggers, and that marriage is a trap that will crush man's adventurous, freedom-loving spirit. One writer says it was an all-out rebellion against the requirements of marital duty. Playboy sneered at marriage as the enslavement of men. The term Playboy itself expressed rebellion. To an earlier generation, it would have been shocking to think that a man should aspire to be a boy. It was equally shocking to think that his goal in life should be to play. This is boy culture for grown-ups. By the 1920s and 30s, in urban areas, for the first time, it became socially acceptable for fathers not to be involved with their families. The father became a kind of secondary parent who covered the extras, right? The hobbies, sports, trips to the zoo. One historian says fathers were reduced to entertainers, to romper room dads. There emerged the familiar image now of fathers as incompetent bumblers, totally inept in their family, who are patronized by long-suffering wives and their clever children. So this was the image popularized by the comic strip Dagwood Bumstead, Al Bundy on Married with Children, The Simpsons, and the beleaguered father Bear in the Berenstain Bear picture book series. Are these familiar to you? The one I know best is Berenstain Bears, because I had one son who loved the Berenstain Bears. We read them all. That's one, junk food. The mother bear decides the family has to stop eating junk food, and of course it's Papa Bear who sneaks his favorite snacks. Or they have no TV week. Mother decides the family needs to give up TV, and Papa Bear sneaks downstairs at night to watch it on the sly. So it's books where it's the mothers who impose rules and childish fathers who break them. Even the children scold Papa Bear for his infractions. It's all presented as humorous, of course. Let's teach children to feel superior to their incompetent fathers. As fatherhood lost status, not surprisingly, men showed a decreasing investment in being fathers. Today, some 40% of children live apart from their natural fathers. In fact, many of these children grow up without ever knowing their fathers. So for many women today, the problem is not male dominance so much as male desertion. So what's the solution? Let's end by seeing how Christianity offers a solution to the war between the sexes. I was reading a Harvard historian recently. He's a secular person, but he made an interesting observation. He said, your concept of God shapes your view of manhood. He said, in cultures that hold polytheism, the gods are constantly fighting, which leads to an emphasis on military valor, the heroic virtues. Think of the ancient Greek gods or the Norse gods. So to be a man was to be a warrior. In monotheism, God is the transcendent creator, which leads to an emphasis on power. Think of Islam. To be a man is to exercise power. In Judaism, God is not only creator, but also father in covenant relationship with his people. So in Jewish culture, to be a man is to exercise fatherly authority. Then Christianity arose, and it made things a little more complex. It retained the Jewish concept of God, but tempered it with the concept of servant leadership. I am among you as one who serves. I am gentle and humble in heart. So Christianity challenged all the earlier notions of what it meant to be a man. Gentleness, love, and compassion were virtues, masculine virtues. So is this just an abstract ideal? How much do Christians actually live out the model of servant leadership in practice? Well, we're in luck, because an in-depth study on Christian families was done by a sociologist named Brad Wilcox at the University of Virginia. So we have empirical data to answer this question. Critics claim that conservative Christians are more likely to practice child abuse and domestic violence. So here's Cokie Roberts, the well-known TV news journalist, says conservative Protestant gender ideology can clearly lead to abuse, both physical and emotional. Two sociologists say, the seeds of wife beating lie in the subordination of females and the subjection to male authority and control, and its conservative religion that makes such relationships seem natural, morally just, and sacred. And even some Christians say that. James Beck is a Christian who identifies as a Christian feminist. And he says the underlying power differential in a marriage sanctioned by a traditional understanding of scripture is related to the abuse of power that characterizes some Christian homes. The trouble with these negative claims is that they're not based on any empirical evidence. So Brad Wilcox conducted several studies in which he compared three groups. Families who attend evangelical churches, theologically conservative, families that attend mainline churches, which tend to be theologically liberal, and families not affiliated with any church, secular people. And what Wilcox found may seem paradoxical. Men who attend evangelical churches do tend to hold to the idea of male headship in the home. They participate less in housework. They do about an hour less of housework per week than other American husbands. And they are more likely to spank their children. So in that sense, they fit all the stereotypes. But these fathers, evangelical fathers, also show higher levels of emotional involvement with both their wives and children. They're more likely to be involved in discipline of their children. They supervise homework, they enforce bedtime, they set limits on screen time, and so on. They're also the most likely to express affection and praise to their children, to spend time on activities with them, like playing with them, reading to them, taking them to soccer practice. They also surveyed the wives. And in evangelical couples, the wives were the most likely to say that their husbands expressed affection and understanding. These wives, of all three groups, ranked highest in terms of saying they felt loved and appreciated by their husbands. And finally, the men themselves were more likely to report that they had that they were very happy in their marriages. Wilcox calls them soft patriarchs because, on the one hand, they fit the stereotypes, the conservative stereotypes, but on the other hand, they also fit the progressive stereotype of warm and emotionally engaged husbands and fathers. So here's how he sums it up. Academics need to cast aside their prejudices about religious conservatives and evangelicals in particular. Compared to the average American family man, evangelical Protestant men who are married with children and attend church regularly spend more time with their children and their spouses. They're also more affectionate with their children and their spouses, and they have the lowest rate of domestic violence of any group in the United States. Now, that last point is especially important, and let me tell you how he got that number. He had to divide out those who are active, evangelicals who are active in their church, versus those who are only nominal, so only cultural Christians. You know, it's people who say, yeah, I'm from Georgia, so of course I'm Baptist. When he made that division, the differences between those two groups is stunning. Nominal evangelicals are the most likely to divorce, most likely of all three groups, by the way. Not just more likely than other evangelicals. They're more likely than mainline Protestants and secular people. So they're at the very bottom. They're the most likely to divorce. Their wives report the lowest level of happiness with their husbands' expressions of love and understanding. And while active evangelical couples report the lowest level of violence of any group, that's 2.8%, nominal evangelicals report the highest of any group, 7.2%. Higher than mainline couples, higher than secular people. And by the way, he did another study with Jews and Catholics, just in case anyone feels left out. Jews and Catholics tended to be on the same level as mainline Protestants. So evangelicals had them, active evangelicals were at the top, mainline Protestants, Jews and Catholics, then secular people, then nominal evangelicals. And this is really, by the way, in domestic violence numbers are incredibly important. Because did you know this? Most people don't. According to the Centers for Disease Control, half of all female homicide victims, half, are killed by current or former male intimate partners. That's husbands or boyfriends or former husbands and former boyfriends. Half. So clearly just believing certain things or being culturally connected to some religious tradition is not enough to change behavior. The key factor is actively attending church. Hearing messages telling men that the family was created by God, it is not some evolutionary accident. Hearing messages that they are accountable to God for how they treat their family. And of course, getting social support from other men who share their commitment to faith and family. Wilcox says churches are one of the very few institutions in American life that actually foster male involvement in the family. As he puts it, it turns men's hearts toward home. So the bottom line is that Christians do have a practical answer to resolving the war between men and women, one that has stood the test of empirical research. And so we can be bold about bringing that answer into the public square as a solution to issues like toxic masculinity and the Me Too movement. And I end with this slide. I just want to tell you, if you want to follow up on any of this, a lot of the history is in my book, Total Truth, chapter 12. And we have time for questions.
Thank you. Now, we do have time for questions, so please take advantage of the mics on either aisle. I'm sure some questions will come to mind. Give us a minute.
I had a question about why do you think there's this anger that seems to be rising among feminists, radical feminists? You talked about at the beginning a quote from somebody saying, you know, that masculinity is, you know, it's toxic, it's really dangerous, there's almost, we can hate men. Why is this becoming so vitriolic almost?
Yeah, well, I was hoping the history would make it a little easier to understand, because as you can see, the expectations for men have gone down consistently over quite a long period. Really, I trace mostly from the Industrial Revolution, when men were taken out of the home and no longer had close day-to-day working relationships with their wives and children. You know, that has to have an impact. And from the literature, we see that it did. And then the problem of boys growing up without fathers and growing up with, like I said, resentment of female standards. It's the sense that they were being asked to live up to a standard that was alien to them. And then in addition, you know, so here's the two, you got to have both sides in there. Men are becoming more toxic, we might say. I don't like using that phrase, actually. But, you know, men are being reinforced that they're crude and brutish and that they're not as moral as women and that that's fine. In the public square, they shouldn't be moral anyway because that's supposed to be the value-free realm. And at the same time, you saw women being told, you're morally superior to men. You have a right to hold them up to certain standards. And it's taken a long time for that to happen. But at dinner tonight, who was I sitting with? The Fairfields are professional musicians, and they gave me some news items to follow up on in the professional music world. It's happening now that they said it's been known for a long time that sexual harassment often happens in the context of music lessons, one-on-one, in a closed practice room. No, oh, there you are. One-on-one in a closed practice room without a window, very, very common. And people have known for a long time that there were men with a certain reputation. But now, women feel empowered to bring that publicly. And we were talking at dinner how, wait a minute, we've known this for years. But now women are being encouraged that to stop putting up with it. So it's been this long, gradual process of you know, men being held to lower standards while women being empowered to challenge those standards. So it's I hope the history has shown, you know, when you go up for a bird's eye view and see things developing over time, it's often easier to see than if you just, you know, take the contemporary world and say, where did this come from?
So 150 years later or whatever, is it now the case that women are still morally superior? You know, that was the message back then, and men were kind of this way. Is it, you know, this many years later, it seems to be the story is, let me give you this here. The story is almost the same, but it seems that there's a new kind of element to it. There's some real anger on the part of women. So,
men are held to a lower standard, they're going to behave worse. I mean, let me go back to this example from dinner. In the professional music world, it's been known for a long time. What does that mean? That means women have been harassed for a long time. And so, yes, there's an anger that has developed over time. Well, the opening example I gave from Silicon Valley, you know, they got, do I need to say anything more than Harvey Weinstein? He got away with it for a long time. So there's a huge backlog of anger from women who were sexually assaulted, sexually harassed, and so on. And so when it finally becomes public, there's this huge backlog of anger. You guys probably, when you talk to your friends about the Kavanaugh hearings, I was very troubled how many of my mostly female friends, without any critical thinking about, presumption of innocence and due process and so on, just looked at Dr. Ford and said, that's my story. That's my story. And the emotional connection to her just drove out all other thoughts. So when you have a backlog of women who that's their story, it's very hard for them to think rationally. They just immediately emotionally identify with it.
Professor, thank you so much for your presentation. I think it was very helpful to see a lowering of standard among men want to check something by you. It seems to me that at least from the sexual revolution in the 60s, there was also a lowering of standards for women as well. I just wonder if you can comment on that, because it seems like there's this myth that women can participate in the same way that men are expected to participate in terms of consumption of alcohol, in terms of sexual activity. It seems like we're starting to reap the seeds of that myth, the lowering of the standards for men, certainly, but also a lowering of standards for women. I wonder if you can comment on that.
Yeah, I've noticed the same irony, that what women said, we can be just as whatever as men. You know, whether it's good things, like we can be in leadership just like men, or whether it's bad things, we can be just as raunchy as men, just as sexually promiscuous as men. We can hold our alcohol just like men. What has struck me is, what standard of men were they trying to align themselves with? This lower standard, that, you know, they're not saying, looking at colonial days and saying, oh yeah, men, spiritual moral leadership, duty, self-sacrifice. They're not looking at that standard of men, the one we heard earlier today from Chris Wiley, very inspiring. No, they're looking at the modern definition that has already been lowered and saying, yeah, we can be like that. And that is, I agree, that's the irony. You see, where it all started was when men left home to follow their work into factories and offices, what were women supposed to do? Well, they couldn't follow. The natural thing would be, well, I'll follow my work out, right? You know, as many of the household industries were taken out of the home and put into factories, it was natural for women to say, well, we should follow our work out of the home. That's what men did. There was only one small problem, or I should say many small problems. Young children. Young children. And so women have been caught between this, the tension of saying, well, you know, what did women used to do in the home? Baking, weaving, cutting, making all their clothes from scratch, candle making, button making, preserving. The home industries were very rich. A woman at home had a lot of interesting and intellectually challenging work to do in the home. After the Industrial Revolution, eventually what was left at home? Early childcare and cleaning. So you can see why the feminists said, okay, the solution is we have to follow men out of the home. That was the first, I'm going to be like men. Follow men out of the home, because our work has gone in out of the home as well. Not just men's work, but women's work has left the home. And so that's why it became so important for feminists to gain control over their reproduction, as they put it. In other words, be able to use abortion and contraception to control the timing of childbearing. And then when they did have children, state-sponsored daycare. So you've got the whole agenda of the feminist movement right there. Once you understand that they wanted to follow men out of the home, that explains the whole agenda.
Depending on what the researcher, I think you were citing Wilcox with sorting out the active evangelicals versus the in name only evangelicals. Did he do any sorting with the active Jews, the active Catholics? And did he sort that out at all? And could you say anything more if he did about rates of violence?
I've read a couple of his studies, because he does a lot. If you want to follow somebody who does a lot of studies on family and marriage and so on, he's great. He himself is Catholic, by the way. So he's not an evangelical who was putting his finger on his thumb on the scale there. He wasn't trying to see evangelicals come out on top. He was actually pretty surprised by that. So he's Catholic, and he has a book out called Soft Patriarchs, and most of what I gave you tonight is from that book, Soft Patriarchs. Then I went online, and it does not cover Jews and Catholics at all. So I went online and read some of his other studies, and they were shorter, and as far as I could tell, he did not parse out, you know, conservative versus liberal, as far as I could tell. Now maybe he has, and some of his many studies, maybe he has, but I didn't find that.
Do you know any of his rationale for, I won't say picking on the evangelicals because he made them look really pretty good, the active evangelical men. But do you know his reasons for parsing out the evangelicals only?
Well, the only thing I can think of is that they're the ones under attack. remember those criticisms? You know,
right.
They're the ones under attack.
Fair enough. Thank you.
kind of a broad question, but as in reflecting on a lot of the different talks, as we think about the Industrial Revolution being the kind of major factor in leading to so many of these things, as a pastor, I look now at my congregation or at others and realize we have no way of rolling it back, no way of going back to the pre-Industrial Revolution kind of home industries. But wondering what are some ways that we can think about that when men are so often out of the home. Telecommuting to me seems to be one of those things that can bring men back into the home some, but I'm wondering what other options we may have or what things as Christians we may need to do and cultivate to return to something that's more akin to what it used to be.
Right. That's a really good question. First of all, let me say we're talking mostly about the period of time when you're raising kids. And so it doesn't mean, for most couples today, that's only a portion of their lives. So we're talking about a strategy that they would want to adopt when their kids are little. And I do see a lot of people trying to restore household functions. I mean, what is homeschooling? Homeschooling is bringing back the educational function. And a lot of homeschooling families are also now trying to build family businesses so that they can recover the function of training their own children and the skills and so on of the work world. And you're right, as we become more and more of a knowledge economy, knowledge workers of any kind can work from home. My older son works for Google. And he was working for several years from home when his child was first born. He has one child, and when his child was young, he was working from home for several years, and it was great because he took his breaks and he took his lunch break with his wife and kid. You know, it was wonderful. Now they are not homeschooling. He's in school and he works downtown. But for the period when the child was home. But pink-collar workers and blue-collar workers can sometimes find ways to work at home, too. I had my hair done once by a woman who had a beauty parlor in her basement so that she could combine her work with being home. And then when we renovated our house in Washington, D.C., before moving out to Houston, where we live now, The guy who redid our floors brought with him his 14-year-old son, who he was homeschooling and who he was training. So even blue collar work can be done at home. I think anything that can be done on a computer obviously is the easiest. Let me give you a fun anecdote. So I was at a conference once, and my book Total Truth was for sale, and it was brand new, and I noticed somebody was reading my book. Instead of listening to the speaker, I thought, well, that's flattering. But then I got worried, though, because he walked out. As soon as it was done, he walked out and started talking really fast and really loud into his phone. I thought, oh, man, he read something that made him mad. He disagrees with something. But then he came up and introduced himself, and he said, I just read you chapter 12, which is on the chapter that's on these issues. And yes, I am so inspired. I immediately called my wife and said, we're going to change our work style. We are going to start a home-based business while our children are young. Because this is the image, this is the vision we want. And he went to Amazon and wrote a review. So you can go read it if you want. His name is Kirk Martin. And so you can read his. He's saying, we're going to start with our own private revolution. You know, my wife and I have decided we are going to, that at least while our children are young, we're going to organize our work so that we can do it from home and raise our kids together. So it can be done, but right now it's more anecdotal. You know, you have individual families all working out their own strategies. It is interesting to me, one of the things that I cut, I had to cut a lot because this talk started too long, but one of the things I caught was some surveys of men. I might be able to find it quickly. The gist of it was that today, when men are asked what they want out of work, do you know the number one thing they say? I want family-friendly schedule. I want to be able to have flexible schedule, some home-based work. That's the number one and on several surveys. Much lower is things like status, salary, and so on. Men are at least verbally today saying, now, admittedly, they don't always feel like they can do it because they're going to get behind. They're more afraid of getting behind professionally. But verbally, you'll find in a lot of surveys, men are responding that the main thing they want out of work is to have it be more family friendly.
Yeah. Well, one more question.
I was going to say, I find myself in a really blessed position where I work from home. I have since I left college, started a business, and so I think there's definitely some opportunities out there if you think about home-based and computer-based work that you can do. My question is that it has introduced to me sort of a different dynamic than I grew up with. My dad left the house. I was, you know, me and my sister were always at home, especially when we got older. But how do you see the dynamics changing? I've already crossed that, how do I have a business at home step. The next step is, how do I now start to recultivate that? Homeschool is one thing we've actually considered, and we've talked a lot about, even co-op down in Texas. And I think I'm a little afraid, because I think it's all of a sudden a new thing for me, where I'm now focused on how do I develop a relationship with my wife better. And so my question is, the dynamics that start to come back, is there a book, is there a place where I can read more about how to develop that dynamic again from, you know, being the dad that's at home, that takes on responsibilities that I didn't think I had to take, you know, and until I watched your presentation today, I just more curious.
There you go. Oh, yeah, that is a good question. Read chapter 12 in Total Truth. I have a lot of books. I cite a lot of books, which might be helpful. You know, once you're out of school, this is how you learn, right? You find a good book, and then you follow all the footnotes to find more books on the subject. You don't have a teacher telling you what to read. That's how you find out what to read. So look at the footnotes there. And you might like reading some the homeschool literature if you haven't started yet, some of the homeschool literature, because, of course, the phrase that's used in homeschool circles is bringing dad back, bringing dad back home. And that's one of the main reasons they start home-based businesses, so that they can bring dad back home.
Especially for millennials, you know, you're looking at a 30-40% workforce population that's now more open to working remotely. It's becoming, I mean, in the United States, it's the freelance space is growing so quickly. So I think it's something that definitely warrants just information to be able to have as a person who is in that position to recultivate those things again. And so, not.
Yeah, so when I was researching for Total Truth, I just went to the library and looked up books on how to start your own business. I read, like I said, homeschool literature on strategies for bringing dad home. That pretty much covers it. You know, read books on home-based businesses and entrepreneurs, home-based entrepreneurship. There's a lot out there. Like you said, it's growing quickly. So there's a lot out there.
Can you talk about the role of class, maybe the last 50 years or today? I'm thinking about single-parent households are much more common among the poor. And then just the last few comments got me thinking about, you know, telecommuting and homeschooling. I don't think those are things the poor do a ton of. And so it started to sound like a middle-upper class kind of discussion about what we might do or something. But any thoughts on the poor and the lower class?
Yeah, I wrote an article for some of you know the magazine The World and I. I wrote an article for The World and I a few years ago now on an organization. It was here in Chicago, in fact. It's an organization called Women's Self-Employment Project. And it was dealing with single mothers and poor families. Not all of them were single mothers, but it was a family poor enough that the mother had to work. And it's called the Women's Self-Employment Project. And what they did is some of you may know the concept of microenterprises. Probably all of you know. Microenterprises and how in the poorest of the poor, like in Bangladesh, they start microenterprises. And women, nobody has collateral. So how do they get their startup capital? So they have a small group of people who pool their resources, and one person at a time gets all the resources and gets the loan and starts the business, and then as they get successful, another person. And so and the payback is very high. They've been very successful. So since this was working in Bangladesh, the Women's Self-Employment Project said, how about the poor areas of Chicago? Why not try it here? And so they did, and they had some really fun success stories. It was a kind of personal interest story, and so I highlighted three families. A woman who started a shoe store. She just loved shoes. And so she wanted to start her own company, and she started out of the tailgate of her car at the company where she used to work, so she knew people, and they knew her, and she said, you want to buy my shoes? And it became so successful, her teenage son helped her, and they eventually started a storefront, but it started out of her car. And what was another one? Another woman did wearable art. She did art women who sew, you can make these designs on clothing, and she made wearable art, and she sold them. And her daughter was the model. It was children's clothing, and her daughter would model them, and she would sell wearable art. And what was the third one? Oh yeah, the third one was a Spanish woman, Hispanic, who made. Her goal was to make chorizo, which is, did I say it right? Anyone here is Hispanic? Anyway, it's a Spanish. It's a sausage, yeah. It's a sausage. That's how you said it? Anyway, she wanted to make sausage and she would sell it to Hispanic restaurants. And she would make it at home. And again, one of these women, I forget, did have a husband, and her husband eventually quit his job and joined the family business too. Anyway, this is anecdotal, but it can be done. And this article, Women's Self-Employment Project said, usually the poor are funneled into low creativity, low responsibility jobs, which are not engaging, are not fulfilling. If you teach them how to run their own business, they've got creativity, they've got responsibility, they learn how to keep their books, they can involve their family. They don't have to park their kids in daycare. That's another thing. The poor are usually told, you don't have any choice, put your kids in daycare so you can make money. They don't have to park their kids in daycare because they're working from home. So it actually is better for the poor. They benefit at least as much as more as wealthier families do. Isn't that cool?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.